Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Now, have you ever wondered how your favourite movie was made? Or what it would have been like on set making what would become a classic? Well, plenty of documentaries take you behind the scenes so fans can see what goes on making a blockbuster or a big flop. You don't have to be a film buff to get sucked in. Sometimes there's more drama on set than what ends up in the finished film. Megadoc is one of the most recent ones. It documents the making of Francis Ford Coppola's passion project, Megopolis. It's far from the first time the great director has let cameras follow him and his actors around while they work. Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, is one of the best of this genre, chronicled the turbulent production of Apocalypse Now. There's going to be a whole stack more examples of those with our resident film expert, or I like to call him the movie maestro here at Nightlife, CJ Johnson. He's a lecturer in cinema and president of the Film Critics Circle of Australia. Welcome back, CJ.
Good evening, Greta. How are you?
I'm doing really, really well. And this is a bit sacred, the old CJ film special. I'm really happy to be doing one, actually.
Oh, excellent. This is a really good one. When your producer mentioned this idea, I thought, I'm not sure there are enough movies that fit this sub genre to fill out an hour. And then I had a look through all the films I've looked at and sort of, you know, I've got my own sort of database, and there are plenty. This is a very actually rich trove of films.
It's almost like processing trauma, I think, for the filmmakers to sort of see what went wrong. Maybe a debrief in a way sometimes.
Yeah.
So what's in it for people with only a passing interest in movies? Like, say they like to watch movies, but they're not enamored by the whole film industry. Is it still
fun?
Oh, God,
yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. So the films we're looking at tonight are essentially, in the main, not entirely, the first one isn't this, but then the rest pretty much are feature-length documentaries that were released into cinemas as their own films that you would go pay your proper, you know, $18 for your ticket, whenever, about the making of other films. And in general, they're about the making of a singular film. So when you think about that, when you actually think about what it is, you've got the film Apocalypse Now. And let's say Apocalypse Now was released in 1979 and you went off and you paid, let's say, I don't know what a cinema ticket was then, but let's say it was $10. And then later on in 1991, the film Hearts of Darkness comes out, a feature-length documentary. And let's say at that point, your film ticket was $14. You went off to see it in the cinema and you paid $14. So alongside the feature film you've paid to see is a feature-length documentary about the making. It's like reading a novel, reading a book of notes about the writing of a novel that's the same length as the novel. So in that sense, it's kind of mind-boggling because, you know, you're behind the scenes is as long as the film itself. But the reason it's fascinating is because there is no more fascinating process on earth, as far as I'm concerned, than the making of a feature film. The making of a feature film is one of the most complicated, crazy things to happen. I mean, when you think about a painter in front of a canvas, it's that times a million. You know, you've got, let's say, a big Hollywood production. You've got maybe 100 crew members. You've got all these actors. You've got anywhere from a 40-day shoot to a four-month shoot. These shoots are 6 days a week. They're 12 to 14 hours a day. Sometimes you've got tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on the line. You're shooting in multiple locations. I mean, it is so complicated and is one of those things that only a tiny amount of people on the planet ever get to experience. So to peek behind the scenes at how any film is made is inherently fascinating. Now, if you're peeking behind the scenes at a film that in any way had problems along the way, and I would suggest that 99.9% of films have problems along the way, but if they've got big problems along the way and you capture that, then you've not only got the most fascinating artistic process on the planet, combined with the drama and the conflict that arises from people making mistakes doing about the most expensive thing you can do, which is make a big feature film.
I have to confess that the latter is my favourite because I'm a little bit of a Schadenfreude fiend. I like it when hearing about other things go wrong. It's pretty sadistic, but anyway.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of what we like in drama, right? It's when things go wrong. If you tell me a story about getting here safely, that's not interesting. But if you crashed your car on the way, you've got a story.
Otherwise it's just PR, right? Yeah, it's just spin.
Yeah, and that's what we're not looking at. We're not looking at just the legions of making of documentaries that are DVD extras. These are specifically films that are good enough to stand on their own. In fact, most of these films, honestly, you could have just as much fun watching them even if you haven't seen the film that they are about, because they stand up on their own as excellent documentaries.
What film are we starting with? Which making of documentary would you like to kick off with?
Well, having said all that, I am going to break my own rule for the first one, because the first one is just a 36-minute film. It's not an actual feature-length documentary. And it really was, ultimately, I mean, it was screened on television, I think, and then it was ultimately one of the first great DVD extras. And that is Vivian Kubrick's short film, 36 minutes, Making the Shining. And I want to talk about this because it is earlier than any of the others. And so it sort of kickstarts this idea, but it also encapsulates within it a lot of the things that make this sub genre of documentaries good.
Okay.
So Vivian Kubrick is Stanley Kubrick's daughter. And when he was making The Shining, he allowed her to make Making the Shining. So just to hang around with a camera and a sound unit. So a tiny crew, it would have just been a camera person and a sound person and her, and just unobtrusively film what was going on. And that's all it is. It's 36 minutes of you are there watching it. There's no one talking. There's no narration. There's nothing like that. There's just shots of behind the scenes making the film. But what she captures is her father doing great work with Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, but also doing the kind of work that after 2017 is not what's allowed anymore, and especially with Shelley Duvall.
Yes, yes.
So you're essentially watching him berate her in front of the crew. And I mean, if you wanted to use this word, you could look at the footage and say he's bullying her. And this exists. And his daughter shot it, and his daughter edited it, and his daughter said, this is the final product. And assumedly, if you're father is Stanley Kubrick and you made this film about him, you probably showed him the final cut before you sent it off to the TV station and said, what do you think of this? So they both essentially locked off on it, and it is not a flattering portrait of Stanley Kubrick. Now, whether or not when you are at that level of artistic, creative genius and acclaim and all of this, you cannot see your own faults. You're staring at yourself on a screen berating your lead actress and you can't see that that doesn't make you look good, or whether you're beyond that and you're like, I don't care because I know the film I made and that's what I needed to do to get the performance from the actress, and so people may as well see it. Lord knows why he said, sure, Vivian, by all means, that's good, put that up there, but that's what you get. And it's that honesty, that raw honesty, that makes it absolutely compelling, because you're watching, there's one particular sort of set piece in the film where he needs her to do something and she's not doing it in the way that he wants it, and he dresses her down. And the way he does it is it's humiliating, because he says, da-da-da-da-da, Shelley, everyone's freezing, you're holding up the whole crew. You know, he puts this burden on her, and it's a scene where she's having to be terrified of the fact that her husband is trying to kill her with an axe, spoiler for The Shining, and that's what he wants to get out of her. He needs more of that. And so whether the whole thing is calculated or not, it's really uncomfortable to watch, and that's what's in it. And it's deeply, deeply fascinating. You cannot look away.
Oh, I need to hear it. Let's say in this clip from the doco, it's called Making of The Shining. Stanley's mother, Gert, so that's Shelley Duvall's character, asks Jack Nicholson and Stanley Kubrick about the different coloured scripts used on set. Gert asks if Jack is exaggerating when he says he just gets a new script each day. Both Stanley and Jack say nope in tandem.
It's so that you start with white, then you go to blue, then pink, then green, then yellow.
But what happens?
It's so that when everybody's got their script out, you can look right over and know if they've got the latest version. But of course, you never have the latest
blue
version.
Blue or yellow isn't significant. No. Just colors.
I quit using my script. I just take the ones they type up each day.
Aren't you exaggerating a little bit?
No.
Oh, sorry, CJ. It's not Shelley Duvall's character. For some reason, I got my wires crossed. No, that's his actual. That's Stanley Kubrick's actual mother.
Stanley Kubrick's mother came to the set and she was like, "Why is your script all these different colors?" And Jack Nicholson sounding so Jack Nicholson that he sounds like a parody of Jack Nicholson. Yeah. He sounds like an actor doing Jack Nicholson. Is explaining to her in his laconic, slightly bemused way why there are various pink pages and blue pages, and that's the kind of thing you learn when you watch documentaries like this. I mean, the vast majority of people do not know that on film sets, everyone's carrying around scripts that are full of pink and yellow and blue pages. And what do they mean? And this kind of thing explains to you why that is the case and how it works.
Mm. Yeah, it's but don't get me started on the genius pass there, CJ, because, you know, potentially we can speculate all we want, but my two cents for why Stanley would keep that conflict in this particular documentary made by his daughter would be to commit to authenticity.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what happened. That's how it was put on screen.
Yeah, I'd like to think so too. And also it was his daughter, you know, and if she was going to go that way, then I think he might have said, okay, if you want to go that way, go that way. And he was unassailable. I mean, you know, when you reach a certain level and he had reached that level, it wasn't really going to, you know, it was almost more interesting for him to be fully rounded out there in the public consciousness.
That's right. And maybe even it's a comment made by his daughter by including him berating Shelley Duvall to sort of say, this is how you are, Dad. You
know,
maybe it was saying something she couldn't verbally,
So I don't know how listeners can see that unless they've got DVDs of The Shining hanging around, because it's most famously on that. But it might be on YouTube, actually.
Most
that's the
likely.
Kind of thing that's probably on YouTube.
Yeah, that's the factual stuff is usually on there. Let's get through to the next one. So this was a little bit later, Burden of Dreams.
Oh, Burden of Dreams, 1982, Les Blank. This is magnificent. I just rewatched this actually about 6 weeks ago because it was being screened at a cinema in Sydney. It's about the making of Werner Herzog's film Fitzcarraldo. And Fitzcarraldo is a famously crazy shoot, a famously almost impossible shoot. The film Fitzcarraldo itself is about this opera lover who wants to build an opera house in the Amazon jungle. And to do so, he decides that he needs to become a rubber baron. And to get to these trees where he can get the rubber, he needs to take this big steamship and move it from one river, one part of the Amazon River, to another over a mountain between the two rivers. And so he hires a whole bunch of indigenous people to pull this enormous ship up and over this mountain. And so to make the film, Werner Herzog decided that they would do it, that they would do it in real life. So they'd build the ship, they'd have the ship, and they'd drag the ship over and film it. So it was totally, you know, authentic, as you say. And so, as you can imagine, everything started to go wrong with this idea. And there was a documentary crew there led by Les Blank to film it. And the resulting film is called Burden of Dreams. And it's a brilliant title because Werner Herzog is one of these directors who just has these sort of dreamlike visions for his films, films that seem impossible to pull off. And it is his burden that he can't let it go. And there are multiple times during Burden of Dreams where basically the film completely falls over, where it's basically over, and he just keeps going and he resurrects it, and he's determined to fulfill his dream even though it seems impossible. And he did, and the resulting film Fitzcarraldo is very, very good. Against all odds, he kept on going, but the craziest stuff happened during the course of it, and it's all there now. One of the great crazy things about it is that he worked once again with his favorite actor to work with, Klaus Kinski. And Klaus Kinski was a stark raving lunatic, absolutely bonkers with anger management issues up the wazoo. I mean, a really, really difficult guy. And to watch Klaus Kinski not acting, but just there in the documentary is terrifying. He's a terrifying presence, and you know that he's likely to like freak out and explode at any moment. But Werner Herzog has cultivated over five films with him, this relationship with him, that he can somehow contain him, almost like Kinski's this wild animal, and Herzog is the lion tamer, the only lion tamer that can tame Kinski. So you've got that dynamic going on. You've got all these Native Americans. I think they're Peruvian. Mainly indigenous Peruvians who are having to set up this camp. I mean, so much happens in this documentary. It's just, and to look at it from now, from our perspective, it's mind-boggling. For example, here's one thing that's in there, just there's one of a thousand things that's in there. At one point, Werner is questioned by Les, so is it true that you are actually supplying Native women to the German crew members for, you know, you're conducting basically...
I'm just going to remind, at 1982, this was...
Yeah, 1982. Yep. And Werner's like, well, yes, we've been here for 6 months. There's no other outlet. This is, yes, that's part of what's going on here. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Okay, so Burden of Dreams, Werner Herzog is musing on this bird. And in this clip I'm about to play, he's expressing his unhappiness with this film, Fitzcarraldo, while sitting in a boat.
Even if I get that boat over the mountain and somehow I finish that film, anyone can congratulate me and talk me into finding it marvelous. Nobody on this earth will convince me to be happy about all that. Not until the end of my days.
So when you hear his voice then, through this film, he became iconic because he's got such a unique voice and everyone just sort of fell in love with his poetic sort of way of expressing himself and his sort of beautiful German accent. And so he became very, very famous for his voice and the way he spoke. And so to the point that after this film, he started getting acting offers and stuff like this. And he acts every now and then, like he's in The Mandalorian.
He likes a cameo.
Yeah, loves a cameo. He writes extraordinary books. I mean, I think he's one of the great filmmakers of all time, but he's certainly one of the biggest risk takers of all time. I mean, along with Francis Coppola, who we'll be speaking about shortly, he just will not let anything get in his way. And this movie, Burden of Dreams, it is just jaw-droppingly revealing and entertaining from start to finish.
And I only know Werner Herzog's documentary stuff. I do like factual things. And yeah. It's the same with how he approaches the topics, or even chooses the topics he's going to explore. And the poetic way in which he narrates his explorations of, oh gosh, the guy that used to live with the bears,
Grizzly Man. Isn't that an amazing documentary?
Grim, but good.
Yeah.
And there was one on Dali Routier in Texas, who's on death row, and the way you see it presented, all these things that are absolutely, you know, done to death in the media, presented in this new way with Werner's, it's a very cinematic, filmic, narrative way of making a documentary. That's the stuff of his I'm familiar with. I don't know this one.
Yeah.
Fitzcarraldo, but I'll have to check it out. Okay. Hearts of Darkness. I mean, Apocalypse Now. I mean, how could you not document the making of this?
Yeah, well, this one is, I mean, Burden of Dreams comes close, but I think Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, is the absolute Mona Lisa of all of these. It is just the greatest behind-the-scenes film ever made, because partly the film itself that it's documenting is so monumental. Apocalypse Now is essentially like Fitzcarraldo on steroids, as they say. Fitzcarraldo was just a ludicrous proposition to make. You were making it in the Amazon jungle. You know, all the obstacles to its production were immense. And likewise, Apocalypse Now had the same type of thing. It was being made in the jungle. It was being made in the Philippines by a bunch of filmmakers who didn't understand the culture, da-da-da-da-da. They were making a film about Vietnam.
Well, I'm so sorry. We have to welcome people to Sydney very, very shortly. I've timed this. It's terribly. We keep making a joke. I'm the Aldi Suzanne here, CJ. So sorry to stop you in the middle of that. So at 10:30, we'll be welcoming people. This is, you know, this, we could make a documentary about this right now. Right now. The making of Nightlife, not the right way.
It wouldn't be as entertaining as Hearts of Darkness or Filmmaker's Apocalypse. So
if you've just joined us, you're listening to Nightlife on ABC Radio with Greta Lee Jackson. I'm with our movie maestro, CJ Johnson, talking about making of documentaries that tell us about the making of the big films and the not so successful films. CJ, sorry, I interrupted you in the middle of that Apocalypse Now.
Quite all right.
So sorry.
No, so welcome, Sydney people. Yeah, so Francis Ford Coppola makes Apocalypse Now in the late 1970s, and it goes over budget and over time. He's meant to be in the Philippines for a few months. He ends up being there for something like close to 2 years. His first lead actor, Harvey Keitel, he has to fire after 2 weeks. All that footage has to get scrapped. He gets a new actor, Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen has a heart attack about 4 weeks into production. They have to lock down production. The production had to get locked down because turned off because of cyclones. At one point, because all the units they were using had to go away to fight some rebels. I mean, everything that could go wrong could. And basically, Francis Coppola kind of lost himself while he was there in the Philippines for all this length of time. I'm not going to say he lost his mind, because he clearly didn't, because he returned and kept on making movies and, you know, has continued to be a person who has not lost their mind. But it's almost as though for a couple of years he lost his mind, or at least he lost his way. He lost his sense of self, and he became a combination of an egomaniac and a desperately nervous person. He became all sorts of things that was very, very troubling. And his wife was there shooting the making of documentary the whole time. His wife, was Eleanor Coppola, was following him around with a camera crew. So like Vivian Kubrick made the film Making the Shining about her father, Stanley Kubrick, Eleanor Coppola makes the film about her husband, Francis Ford Coppola, making Apocalypse Now. And the only narration you get in the film is from her own journals. She kept journals, which have been published in a book called Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now. And she is very frank. She's talking about worried that her husband is losing his mind, that he's doing all these things. You know, she's very worried about his psychological state. And to watch the background footage of the creation of this sort of chaotic mess of a production that ultimately, once again, like Fitzcarraldo, resulted in an extremely brilliant movie is just fascinating. There was a lot of drugs too going on set, a lot of drugs, like in Vietnam, all those soldiers started taking drugs, and you know, it happened here and among the people playing the soldiers on this film. And then you've got the problem of bringing in Marlon Brando, who comes to the set unprepared. He hadn't read the book. He hadn't learned any lines. And he was enormously overweight, even though he had promised that he'd be in shape, because he's meant to be playing this Colonel Kurtz. And he arrives looking like, you know, Mount Kurtz. He's got a shaved head and he just doesn't want to act. And so all of a sudden, with this hugely expensive production sitting around waiting, doing nothing, Francis Ford Coppola has to spend hours talking about the character with Marlon Brando. And you're just watching it all and you're just thinking, like, thank God the movie itself is so good, because this is just, but you can't look away. It is that classic train wreck you can't look away from.
I can guarantee you there wasn't time in the shooting schedule to have a character brief with Marlon Brando the day he arrived on set.
Oh, it's beyond. It goes on for 3 weeks. For 3 weeks he has to sit around and talk to him. Oh, yeah. And Brando had this whole pay or play deal, so he was leaving at the end of the fourth week. I mean, it's just monumentally, it's such a good movie.
Look, I used to be in the telemaking biz, short film making biz. I still kind of have one foot there, but I'm getting a little bit triggered by this conversation, CJ. I'm rolling my eyes. I'm like, oh gosh, high maintenance actors and stars. Look, here is Francis Ford Coppola speaking at the 1997 Cannes Film Festival about Apocalypse Now.
My film is not a movie.
My film n'est pas une film. It's a production.
My film is not about Vietnam.
C'est pas au sujet du Vietnam.
It is Vietnam.
C'est le Vietnam.
It's what it was really like. It was crazy.
C'était comment était Vietnam réellement, vraiment, c'était fou.
And the way we made it was very much like the way the Americans were in Vietnam We were in the jungle.
On était au jungle.
There were too many of us.
On était de trop dans l'équipe.
We had access to too much money.
On avait accès à trop d'argent.
Too much equipment.
Trop d'équipement.
And little by little we went insane.
So there you go. You can hear a combination of a kind of distorted megalomania when he's saying, my film is not a film, it is Vietnam. I mean, that's just nonsense.
I mean, come
that's
on,
insane.
Mate. It's movie making, not going to war.
Exactly. But then he follows it with this very actual erudite thing, like, we know we had this too much money, too much equipment, and we gradually sort of lost our minds. Mm. And so there's this combination of megalomania with this actual very insightful understanding of what led him, for example, to make that statement in the first place.
Right, yeah. He said the last part first.
Yeah.
We've got a couple texts through. Dallas in Blackmans Bay in Tassie says that in 2016 we visited the hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, where The Shining was made, though had never seen the movie, and we stayed in a motel in Colorado Springs a few weeks later, and it was on the TV. Oh, Dallas, that must have been quite strange, quite surreal.
Yeah.
And this one's unrelated. Jane says, it's good, it's different, it's Greta. Thanks, Jane. So, CJ, the let's have a look at this next one. We're talking about the making of documentaries. So documentaries that look in how a film was made, either the big blockbusters or the big flops. Tell me about this next one, American Movie.
Well, this is as far away from Hearts of Darkness and Apocalypse Now as we can get, because this is about a guy trying to make a movie and essentially failing. And so the resulting film is not a film, you can see, because the resulting film doesn't exist. So it's an enormously entertaining film called American Movie from 1999, made by a director named Chris Smith. And it's about an American guy named Mark Borkhart, who is obsessed with trying to make a movie called Northwestern. And the way he plans to make that movie is to make a short film called Coven about a bunch of witches, sell that short film as DVDs, and make enough money to then make his feature film. And you're following him going through this process. And so rather than seeing someone at their height, such as Francis Ford Coppola or Werner Herzog or Stanley Kubrick, you're watching someone on the other side. You're watching someone try and break in. You're watching someone at the very beginning, like literally, I need to make a short film and then I need to sell, 10,000 units of that on DVD. And then I need to take that money to make my feature film. And so you're looking at that side of things, and it's hilarious. And it's also deeply sad because this guy's not going to make it. And you really can tell he's not going to make it, but you want him to. He is just adorable in his ambition and his passion. You love him, even though you can tell he's not cut out for this. And it's just this wonderful film of contradictory impulses, because you're rooting for him while you're also thinking to yourself, mate, just do something else. And when you're trying to devote yourself to be a filmmaker, you have to make all sorts of sacrifices, and he is making them. He doesn't have a girlfriend, or if he does, he's not cultivating that side. He's trying to be a filmmaker to the extent of everything else. And he's got this lovely friend who's with him along the entire way, almost a sidekick, who he just gets to do everything. And watching the two of them bounce off each other in this quest, it's just delightful. It's a marvelous, marvelous, marvelous film. And anyone who's seen it will be nodding their heads right now. It's sort of become famous and in fact, it's probably more widely seen than any of the ones we've already talked about, even though it's about someone who never became famous, except he is famous within the context of everyone who's seen this movie loves this guy.
Oh, okay. Well, here he is, the director, Mark Borchardt, as he drives through Milwaukee at dusk.
I was a failure. I was a failure, and I get very sad and depressed about it, and I can't be that no more. Because I really feel like I've betrayed myself big time. Because I think when I was growing up, I had all the potential in the world. Now I'm back to being Mark, who has a beer in his hand and is thinking about the great American script and the great American movie. And this time I cannot fail. I won't fail. It's not in me. You don't get second chances and mess them up. You'd be a fool to.
Oh, it's all consuming, that passion to break into the film business, isn't it?
Yeah, and he is full of it. And that's what you need. I mean, he's got all the elements. And in fact, watching him make Coven is quite interesting because it's very much, his aesthetic is very much, it's how Peter Jackson got into the business. Peter Jackson essentially made his first film for practically, you know, $1,000 in his mother's kitchen. And you're watching this guy, Mark Burkhart, make the same exact type of film in his mother's kitchen and breaking his mother's cabinet, just like Peter Jackson did when he made Bad Taste. But Peter Jackson became Peter Jackson, and Mark Burkhart is most famous for this film about him not being able to make a film.
Poor Mark, poor Mark. Poor Terry Gilliam, the next example. I know this one quite well, but just before we show that one, I was talk about that one. Chris from Perth says that 1969's The Wild Bunch by Sam Peckinpah is a journey of madness into the deep countryside of Mexico with William Holden, Ernest Borgnine. It literally broke the director and actors. Oh, we might have to look into that one. Have you heard of that one, CJ?
I've heard of The Wild Bunch, but is he saying that there's a documentary about the making of The Wild Bunch?
Is there a documentary, Chris? Let us know. We'd love to know about it. You can tell us about it. Give us a call, 1-300-800-222. But back to Terry Gilliam, of course, of Monty Python fame originally, Lost in La Mancha.
Lost in La Mancha, 2002. So Lost in La Mancha is about Terry Gilliam's attempt to make a film called The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which is an adaptation of Don Quixote. And he eventually did make that film in 2018 with Adam Driver. But this is about him making it way back in 2000. And it stars Johnny Depp and a French actor named, whose name is escaping me at the moment, but it'll come to me. And it's once again an example of everything that can possibly going wrong. But you've got Terry Gilliam, who is indefatigable. He is determined to make this film on his own terms, in his way. And he was really, really, at that time, around 2000, he was huge because he'd made films like Brazil and Time Bandits. He was a big director, 12 Monkeys. He was a big director. And he wanted to make this film, and really, on reality, it was actually a relatively simpler film than a lot of the films that he'd made. And he had Johnny Depp in the cast, and yet it just fell apart for all sorts of reasons, and it keeps falling apart. And again, watching this film gives you this absolute sense of just how hard it is to make a movie. Because if someone like Terry Gilliam, working with Johnny Depp, who was also huge, huge, massive at the, you know, top of his fame in 2000, couldn't get this thing going, then how does anyone? And it all came down to, actually, Jean Rochefort, who's the French actor, basically, one of the biggest things that happened was he got hemorrhoids. So they, you know, they're...
You have to ride horses in Man of La Mancha.
In every scene. I mean, in every scene, you've got to be on that horse. And Jean Rochefort got hemorrhoids and he couldn't be on the horse. And that's ultimately was the nail that nailed the coffin shut on this film.
Do you know why I love that so much, CJ? I love that so much because movies is all about, oh, look how amazing and magical, it's make-believe and it's all fluff. And then at the end of the day, everybody's got butts, you know what I mean?
And you can't have hemorrhoids on a horse. And every scene he was on a horse, the whole thing. There's that moment in the film where they're just, the penny drops for all of them and the camera is rolling on them. And we're seeing them realize that because of this guy's hemorrhoids, this film is going to be cancelled by the end of the day. Oh. And they've already shot all this footage. I mean, they've spent millions of dollars already. I mean, it's just tragic.
Now, here is the first AD, poor bugger, Philip A. Patterson. I'm just feeling for him.
He's a big presence in this film.
Yeah, he's talking about the chaos that is Terry Gilliam.
Every film is different. It's very hard to compare a Terry Gilliam film to anybody else's films. It's very hard to say what's right or wrong, but this film is in, I'd like to say, complete disarray. Absolute and faffing total disarray. But it is absolutely the correct way it should be, given that it's Terry, given that it's a Gilliam film, because Captain Chaos is completely in his element at the moment.
Oh. You can hear he's Australian.
Yes.
Yeah. Australian first AD who survived the making of the first making of the man who killed Don Quixote.
Charlie has texted in and has asking, wasn't Terry also a nightmare of director? Like, so it's the same as what we were saying, Stanley Kubrick, you know, kicking off and making set a bad time. Was Terry one of those?
I don't know. I think many directors are, and many of, you know, the men who made movies prior to, let's say, I don't know, 2010. I mean, I think at that level, at the level of, you know, big, expensive movies, movies that cost tens of millions of dollars, with movie stars shot in foreign locations, with long, long shooting schedules, etc. I think you kind of need to be a bit of a megalomaniac, because you need to keep this thing going. I mean, the pressure on you would be enormous. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine somebody giving you, let's say, $60 million and saying, like, this better deliver. This better be good, and it better make $100 million, because this is riding all on you. And that's what you're feeling for about 2 years of your life, you know, that's the pressure. So I think a lot of directors at that level have got probably black marks against them on a day-to-day level from people who worked under them, because I think inevitably there are cracks in the... I think it would be very hard to remain cool, calm and collected and nice and pleasant to everyone in that job. And so that's not to excuse them, but I think that in answering your question, has Terry Gilliam probably yelled at people and thrown chairs and done all this? I'm sure he has, and I'm sure thousands of them have.
I will say this to you, though, CJ. I know we're talking about making of documentaries, but I want to give a shout out to comedy directors, because comedy sort of isn't as revered. Comedy films are not as revered as the big dramas, the big blockbusters, but that director has that pressure on them from the investors or the stakeholders or whatever, and they've got to keep the vibes up. They've got to keep people being able to deliver that comedy, and that throwing stuff and yelling and humiliating people, that is a comedy killer. That is a vibe killer on a comedy set. So
absolutely,
I feel they need a little bit more respect, because that's hard,
absolutely,
you know, to bury it down and get on with it.
Yeah, and of course not every director is like that. So I guess I...
No, I know what you're saying, yeah, though, for sure.
And,
yeah,
and so it is interesting, isn't it, that to... That's partially why these making of documentaries are also so fascinating, because you are seeing directors at work, and directors, especially big directors, directors of big, expensive, long shooting things with that amount of pressure, they're a breed apart. They're a very, very particular type of person who can handle that. And so to watch them at all at work is inherently fascinating.
And Charlie's clarifying, he says he was just referring to him being shambolic, I think. Yeah, well, that was confirmed by his first AD, Charlie, in that little clip there. So you were right. Just before we move on to the next example, just going back to Burden of Dreams, Werner Herzog documentary about Werner Herzog's film. Kathy says that she watched Burden of Dreams in Hobart in 1983 at the height of the Franklin Dam campaign, and there were scenes in the film where enormous trees were being ripped down, and members of the audience had been on the Franklin trying to prevent the dam being built. Some had been jailed. The scenes were so triggering, the members of the audience were crying and calling out, "No, no, stop."
It was an
unforgettable experience.
Wow.
Wow.
Sure, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Charlie in Carlton says, wasn't Bad Taste, Peter Jackson's Bad Taste, a stalwart of the video library shelves? That cover is so iconic.
Yeah, it is iconic.
I have a friend, we're going to talk about it later, who made a horror film, and the documentary about the horror film is one of these making of documentaries that we are talking about, and Bad Taste reminds me of this film.
Yeah.
But we'll move on. We'll get to, the title gives it away, okay, this one. Best Worst Movie,
oh,
CJ.
What about Overnight?
Oh, Overnight. Oh, let's go back. Yeah, Overnight.
Yeah.
That seems to be not in my examples.
Oh, we've got to, I've got to throw in Overnight from 2003. I might have updated the list and you didn't get the update. Overnight is a film about a person who's being given it all and he blows it. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely riveting, riveting watching. So Overnight is about a guy who wrote a script that's basically an absolute Quentin Tarantino ripoff called The Boondock Saints. His name is, what was his name? He's such an awful guy.
Troy Duffy.
Yeah, Troy Duffy. So Troy Duffy wrote this script. He's a Boston bouncer, and he wrote this script called The Boondock Saints, and Harvey Weinstein optioned it and bought it and agreed to let him direct it and said that Miramax Films, Harvey and Bob Weinstein's company, was going to make it. And he even, to sweeten the deal, bought the bar that Troy Duffy liked to hang out and drink in Los Angeles with all of his mates that he brought over from Boston. So what you've got is, you know that TV show Entourage?
Yes, yes.
So you've got a kind of Entourage thing going on in real life. It's this guy, Troy Duffy, and like seven of his friends. And they're all in a band together as well called The Brood. And Weinstein says, okay, and we're also going to get a record deal for your band, The Brood. And so everything is going these guys' way. He's going to get to direct his own script at a big budget with movie stars, and his band is going to get a record deal. And they're just all absolutely celebrating, and you watch his head expand to the size of Parramatta, and he just destroys everything. And he's got anger management issues, and he treats his friends appallingly. He treats Harvey Weinstein badly. He treats Harvey Weinstein's executives badly. They drop him. He has to take the project to another studio. He treats them badly. He gets agents at CAA. He treats them badly. He gets the record deal. He treats the record executives badly. And he loses everything.
Sounds like Ellen.
And he let one of his friends, you know, film this whole thing. So you're watching it all happen. And what you're watching is this incredible, I've thought of so much about the film. I watched it 2 weeks ago. I've thought so much about the film since. You're watching actually someone who's so small-minded, who's so narrow-minded, that they are not Terry Gilliam or Francis Ford Coppola or Werner Herzog, and they never can be, because to them, all they want to do is actually be the big man in the room of their established set of friends. He's more interested in yelling at a Miramax executive on the phone to prove to his childhood friend that he is still the top dog in the friendship, rather than go out there and make a movie and make 14 movies and try and become Quentin Tarantino. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's a small man, and he's given a big thing to do, and he realizes, I can't do the big thing, so he self-destructs. And you're watching him self-destruct over the course of 93 minutes. It's fascinating.
Can't do the big thing, or doesn't have the capacity at all to do the big thing. So we don't have a clip from that, unfortunately. Charlie again says, aren't comedy directors notorious for being a-holes? I'm thinking Lorne Michaels, who was the inspiration for Dr. Evil. CJ, do you know if Lorne Michaels directed the affiliated films with Saturday Night Live, or did they have their own?
I don't think so. I think he's just the producer of Saturday Night Live. I've always heard nothing but nice things about him.
Yeah, no, it's mixed. I can see where Charlie's coming from, but I don't think he was on set directing comedy films. I'm not saying that all are amazing, but I'm just saying it's something I've noticed. Taika Waititi would be a good example of someone who has a fun set to keep the comedy up.
Have you been on a Taika Waititi set?
I know him.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. All New Zealanders know each other, CJ. It's a thing.
Oh, right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You'll meet a New Zealander and they'll go, oh, you're from New Zealand. Do you know Steve? And you'll go, no, I don't. And you go, Steve who? And they go, oh, Steve Smith from this suburb. And you go, oh, actually, I do. I went to primary school with him. It's one of those things. All Kiwis know each other. So moving on to the making of docos, because, I mean, this is the thing. There is an absurdity. There isn't a comedy in these documentaries. There are the wheels falling off.
Oh, yeah. I mean, watching Overnight, it's hard to sit through because you're cringing at this guy's behavior and you just think like, no, don't do this. But once again, it's this train wreck, car crash type of thing that makes them so, so compelling. And they are quite funny, because you're laughing at the audacity of some of these people, whether it's the audacity to pull a boat over a mountain in the Amazon, or the audacity to yell at Harvey Weinstein. You know, there's one moment where he yells into a phone and then he hangs up the phone, and you're thinking to yourself, you just blew it. You just blew what every aspiring filmmaker in the world wants, and you just blew it.
Ironically, you're doing what you've seen in the movie.
Yes.
Probably.
Yeah, and you can tell he's doing it for the camera too. Oh. And there's a lot of drinking involved, you know, day drinking too. Anyway.
Well, if it had some kind of, you know, related inspiration for Entourage, you know.
He ended up making the film. He had to make it at a fraction of what he was originally going to make it for. It flopped, and then it sort of did well on DVD and became a bit of a cult hit. So he actually ended up getting to make the sequel too. So he's made two films, okay. the original film and a sequel.
That reminds me of Tommy Wiseau in The Room. I don't know. I hope we have time to mention that right at the end. But best worst movie.
Oh, we're not going to have time. It's 5 to 11.
5 to 11.
Best worst movie is a film about a film I haven't seen. So this is my example of a film that the feature-length documentary is entertaining enough that you can enjoy it without having seen the film. Because it's a film about the film Troll 2. And Troll 2 is supposedly terrible. I mean, supposedly just unbelievably execrably bad. And this film is about the fact that Troll 2 has all these fans all over the world who love it for how bad it is. So that's what it's about. And that relates to what you're talking about The Room. The film The Disaster Artist is a narrative feature film about the making of The Room, which is this famously terrible, terrible, terrible movie. So you've got a big movie star. Who was it? James Franco?
Yes.
James Franco playing this terrible director named Tommy Wiseau, and it's just hysterical.
I give him a genius pass, though, because this movie is so bad that it is the often called the worst movie ever made, and yet it inspired a Hollywood feature film about the making of.
Yeah. So, like, this film, which he made for, you know, whatever, he somehow managed to get together something like $1 million.
Nobody knows.
Not that you can see it
on
screen. Nobody
knows.
But then, you know, this $12 million film gets made about the making of his terrible $1 million film.
So, I went to a midnight screening. That's how popular this thing was.
Oh, they're so good, aren't they?
10 years after the fact, in Los Angeles, went to a screening. Tommy was there. He was wearing two belts. Don't ask me why. He got up, didn't do any Q&A. But said hello. Franco and the Franco brothers were there, and that was years before the film was made. And I was like, oh, wow, this is a thing. This is a phenomenon, The Room. Can we do a special on The Room, CJ?
Sure.
Okay, great. Okay. I'll hold you to it.
And the guy who wrote The Disaster Artist, the book, was Greg Sestero.
He signed my copy.
So when I had a radio show about movies here on the ABC, he came in and I interviewed him.
Stop. I'm so jealous. Nice guy. Lovely guy.
He was nice.
Yeah, that's
it. He was nice. He didn't have a lot to say, but he was nice.
Well, someone helped him write that book because it is the funniest thing, The Disaster Artist.
He nodded
artist.
A lot and smiled.
Classic. So Karen wants to know, what was the one called The Guy Given Everything But Blows It? What was it? That was
Overnight.
Overnight. Overnight, Karen.
From 2003.
And Chris from Perth is telling us that The Wild Bunch, an album in montage. John Wayne said The Wild Bunch killed the Western. That's Chris from Perth. That was the documentary about it.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Thank you, Chris. Oh no.
Shall I pick one more from the rest of the list?
I think so.
Okay. We've got to pick from 2014, Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. So in 2012 or 13, Richard Stanley, a South African director, tried to make a version of The Island of Dr. Moreau with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer.
Here we go again.
And everything went wrong, including Marlon Brando at this point was just taking the, you know, and just being a real troublemaker. And Richard Stanley got fired off the project. And so they hired another director to make it because it was in production. So he got fired and there was a set and all the actors there. So they had to fly in a new director. And they got John Frankenheimer to take over. So The Island of Dr. Moreau, if you know, it's about a mad scientist who's living on an island and he creates all these mutants, right? And so there's all these mutants and the mutants were played by all these extras in all this makeup, like creepy creature mutants, half human, half animal type things. So Richard Stanley, who's been fired from the film, goes off, sneaks around, lingers for a while, comes back and gets himself hired as one of the extras in mutant makeup.
Oh my gosh.
And goes back onto set and plays one of the mutants in the film he'd been fired off.
Oh,
and that's,
wow.
This is all documented in this documentary.
Wow. Okay.
Can you beat that?
Can we hear a little bit of it? Here's a clip from the Lost Soul trailer.
Did you hear about, oh my God, the Richard Stanley climbed into a tree today. It wouldn't come down.
He was living and breathing Moreau and then literally just have that murdered. I think he probably went a bit mad.
I think once that rumor started that Richard Stanley was in the background, that I think that just grew into Richard Stanley then wanting to sabotage.
Oh, there we go. CJ, we're running out of time. I'm so disappointed. It was getting really, really, really fun. And Chris, no, we're not thinking people self-destructing is fun. We're saying that as a result of his own bad behaviour, it fell apart for him. That's what we're saying, Chris. CJ, always a pleasure. I think we need to do a part two and definitely a special on The Room. Thank you so much for joining Nightlife.
Take care, Greta.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.